Are there events or things that happened in your early life and work that ultimately led you, now when you look back, to founding Bioneers?
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that, actually. It's kind of interesting because both my brother and I ended up doing parallel work completely independent from each other, and we're not in close touch during the earlier years. But, you know, for one thing, my father was a teacher, and so we would get these glorious three-month summers every year.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents used to take us, and before it was cool, you know, to Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket when it was a very low-key, you know, situation. But for 3 months, my brother and I just got turned loose outdoors with our, you know, bicycles and baseball bat and fishing pole and crabbing net. And, you know, I didn't really have any idea till many, many years later the profound impact that that had on me of just being so connected to nature. You know, it's very tragic today with the situation with children, of all the fear around safety and letting kids run wild outdoors and stuff like that. But had a, you know, a lifelong influence on me, really.
Let me just jump in for a second. I remember that I lived in subdivisions growing up. You know, that's where we seem to be, in the tract house subdivisions. But for a couple of years, end of middle school, start of high school, I lived just a few blocks from the St. John's River in Jacksonville. And my biggest memories, the ones that sort of stick out the most, are not of high school and football and so on, but I had this one buddy, and I would go down and hang out on the riverbank among the Spanish moss, and once we found an old boat that had been abandoned, and it became our little adventure thing. And it is interesting that while that life looked so, you know, straight and narrow, that there was this little window, which probably shows up in how I look at the world.
Yeah, you know, it's really profound. And there was a visionary biologist named Lyle Watson, who just sadly died last year, but he wrote an incredible book called Dark Nature, A Natural History of Evil. And from the point of view of an ecologist, he looked at things that, you know, what would be the natural conditions that might correspond to behavior that, you know, would be really egregious, you know, infanticide and genocide and, you know, all those kinds of things. And three principles that he found was that it was about disconnection from place, and that when people get disconnected from their place and moved even not a very long distance away, very, very bad things happen. And if you extrapolate that just a little bit further out, you know, sort of on a metaphor level, you know, I think people at large, as a species, we've become very disconnected from our place, you know, the earth. And that's leading to, as we know, many, many crises.
So tell folks to whom this is new. I certainly gave an introduction in the introduction, but add what you will about the Bioneers Conference, the word Bioneers, the vision, the aims, and so on.
Yeah, you know, it grew out of a number of experiences that I had in the 70s and 80s, where, you know, anybody who was paying attention at that time was acutely aware that we were in the midst of, you know, heading headlong into an environmental crisis. And the issue for me is, okay, well, that's really bad, but what are we going to do about it? And I just kind of one by one, you know, I've been a journalist for a long time, and I'm just a curious individual, and I started to look out there for people who were coming up with solutions. And one by one, I began to find all these remarkable individuals, and the common pattern among them was that they had all looked to nature to understand essentially nature's operating instructions, because nature has done everything that we want to do without mining the past or mortgaging the future. And because of that, you know, they were people who'd looked into the deep biology of the planet, so I called them Bioneers. and ended up, you know, somewhat serendipitously founding the first conference in 1990 in Santa Fe with my partner Nina Simons, and where we live. And it was an experiment. We had no idea what would happen. I figured, for one thing, all these people must know each other, because it was a very small world in those days, you know, over 20 years ago. And when we convened and all got together, you know, two things happened. First, it was almost like a revival meeting. The work was so profound and so profoundly inspiring. And really, here were all these genuine, authentic solutions that fundamentally, we're looking at nature, you're looking at living systems, which means you're using systems thinking. So that's probably the core of the work is systems thinking. But they had come up with really profound, you know, solutions to many of our most, you know, our greatest challenges. And then the other thing that I learned in the course of those few days was that even people in the same field often didn't know each other. And immediately alliances started to form, or collaborations, cross-pollination of ideas, you know, just tremendous synergy occurred. And so that's really been the game ever since, is the solutions focus and the building of kind of what we call a network of networks. And if you're looking at a system, everything is connected and everything is interdependent. And that means you can only solve the whole problem. You can't look at just the food system or the economic system or justice or technology. You've got to look at it all together. So that's really what it's about.
Okay, Ken Ozbell, though many of as you've said, the ideas, the participants, even speakers, return to Bioneers. There are people who are there every year, people that have been there 10 times, that sort of thing. Yet at the same time, I assume that the event and the vision evolves. Could you talk about that, and what are some of the key themes or innovations that you expect this year?
Sure. Well, you know, it is a living system, and, you know, our goal is to really help capitalize and support real change on the ground. It's not an academic or abstract, you know, orientation. And I think, you know, every year it's kind of interesting for me because I give an opening talk, and it's for me like a New Year's Eve moment where I try to look back over the past year and take a snapshot of where we've come to. And so I'm in the middle of that right now. But what I'm witnessing personally is actually, as filmmaker Tom Shadyac in L.A. puts it, is hitting the fan. And I think that the shift that we've all been heralding and looking toward is actually now gaining traction in the world. There's no question of that. The U.S., in fact, stands to be left behind if we don't get our act together. You know, Europe and China are far ahead of us in many ways, and other places around the world. But I think across the board, we're seeing a global recognition that we have a very serious problem, and we're starting to address it. So that is very encouraging. And, you know, there are a number of areas where the rise of renewables is unquestioned. It is the next industrial revolution, and those that are seizing the high ground are going to be major winners in that regard, you know, particularly in Europe and in China right now. China no longer wants to be the factory to the world, and they're seizing the high ground on clean technology development and the intellectual property that goes with that and so forth. So that's a real game changer. And I think we're just going to see more and more, you know, in a weird way, we're in sort of this tween state right
mm-hmm.
now.
Yeah.
Where we've still got one foot on the fossil brake and one foot on the green accelerator, and we're kind of going in these fits and starts. But I think we're going to be releasing the brake here pretty quick. And, you know, some people say that what's going to be needed to really tip things, because it still is not remotely big enough, fast enough. I mean, it's a game of beat the reaper here.
Yeah.
But I think that what, you know, people say, well, some giant catastrophe will happen. It just happened in Russia this summer, you know, with massive forest fires, a loss of 25% of their grain, record temperatures, you know, 90 degrees in Moscow, never happened before that we know of. You know, so Russia has suddenly tipped, you know, Medvedev is, everybody's talking about climate change. But at the same time, you know, you look at the BP spill and, you know, horrific heat waves in this country, the hottest year on record worldwide. So there's plenty of catastrophe to go around. And I think in this actually may be more an issue of national competitiveness, because we're about to, you know, we're an empire in rapid decline. And if we don't redirect our economy toward a sustainability initiative, we're going to be left in the dust.
Right. Yeah. The need for a focus on green tech as the next wave, not just of innovation, but of economics. While that was what was called for, America instead went into financialization, and more and more of our brains and our income and our focus went into that, and we've seen that explode over the last couple of years. By the way, next week my guest will be Tom Gagin. And he has a new book called Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? And he points out that while what we hear more about is China, that a country that in some ways is more similar to us and has taken a very different path is Germany, both in terms of how they do capitalism, which is a much more human face on the capitalism in Germany, and how they do technology. For those of you who don't know, America is half as energy efficient as Europe or Japan. In other words, every gallon of fuel, every bit of energy that we use, we get half out of it for what those other countries do. And we've got to wake up to that. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Ken Ozabel. He's the founder director of Bioneers. Their 2010 conference takes place October 15th to the 17th in San Rafael, California. You can learn more at bioneers.org. That's B-I-O-N-E-E-R-S, bioneers.org. I'm going to bring in Tom Lindsay in a second, one of the social innovators that I first met at Bioneers, but I'm going to ask you one question that I don't want to get lost. When you look at you do the event every year, and so every other year you're in mid-October with an election coming up about 3 weeks later. How does the fact that an election that takes place a couple of weeks later influence the conference beyond the fact that participants who are there are not working their home districts that weekend? But just how do you think about that?
Well, it doesn't really affect us all that much in the sense that we take a long view. And I think that, you know, the politics in this country are so stuck right now. I had very low expectations, for example, of Obama. You know, he was very clear during his campaign and by his record that he's a centrist. And I think that when you get to the federal level, there's just, you know, you've got your hands tied in so many ways. They say, I forget who made the quote, but oil is the original sin in American politics. And, you know, that's really still what's running the show for the most part. So I think all of that's going to change in the fairly near future for, you know, because of competitive reasons. But the elections don't influence us all that much. And I think really we're, from our perspective, we're the most active and progressive change is happening is largely at the more local and regional level. It's mayors and county commissioners and governors that have really, you know, decided to run with change. And, you know, the dilemma, of course, now is budgets are down and, you know, and there's real concern, obviously, around that. But still, that's pretty much where it's going on. One of, you know, our plenaries this year will be one of our projects actually called Dreaming New Mexico, where we're trying to create that shift at the state level, and we've worked on both energy and food systems. And Peter Warshall, the co-director of the project, who's the former editor of Whole Earth Catalog, among many illustrious credits, but we mapped the entire food system of the state of New Mexico in a way that has been done anywhere in the country to look at the entire system, and then held a strategic convening to bring about over 100 key players from every level of society, government, business, academia, NGOs together, who for the first time saw themselves as a system and were actually looking for how to shift the entire food system at the state level. You know, David Orr is doing a similar project in Ohio at where he partnered the College of Oberlin, where he has been the head of environmental studies, with the town of Oberlin, and they have a very tangible plan to go carbon neutral by 2020, including a major downtown redevelopment, a 20,000-acre agricultural and forestry belt. And, you know, that's the kind of initiative where I think we're going to really see a lot of traction in the coming years.
Very good. Also, for those who let me say one thing. In my fund drive show 2 weeks from now, we're going to feature some Bioneers books and CDs of talks and so on, and some tickets to the conference. So that'll be the 10th of October. So those people who feel they can make the plan and do it by the end of that week. But you also stream it. Can you tell? Is basically bioneers.org where people can find out about the stream?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing it up, Terry. And we just experimented last year. We're going to be webcasting two or three of the plenaries each day, but what we're doing, which you know something about, is we're partnering with Terry to do a daily two-hour segment called Backstage at Bioneers. And we're setting up a whole room to have some really dynamic, interesting conversations with many of the, you know, cutting-edge leaders of our time across every subject you can think of. And what's going to be fun about it is it's going to be very spontaneous and dynamic. It's not going to be just a rap. It's going to be real, you know, dialogue among all these folks. So obviously excited to innovate with you on that this
year. Yeah. So I will be the anchor of this two-hour segment. So in the mornings are the plenaries, and in San Rafael. And as he said, two or three of those will stream out on the web, and then we will go to 2 hours of live TV on the 15th, 16th, and 17th of October, in which we've got all these great people there, and I'll be doing my best, working with Kenny and some other folks at Bioneers, to get two or three of them, two or three or four of them every half hour on one of the big issues, and put out as much exciting information as we can. And again, information about all that is available at bioneers.org, B-I-O-N-E-E-E, E-E, I added one, E-E-R-S, bioneers.org. So I'm going to bring in, as I said, one of the social innovators that I first heard and became aware of at Bioneers a few years ago. I believe I first heard Tom Lindsay give a plenary in 2006 in which he talked about the work of his organization, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF. And you can learn more about their work at celdf.org. This is exciting work. I remember each year this sort of one talk that I go, wow, you know, I didn't know that was happening, and I want to learn more. And Tom Lindsay was that year. The mission of CELDF is to build sustainable communities by assisting people to assert their right to local self-government and expand and recognize the rights of people, communities, and nature. They do not take corporate dominance of their communities, resources, and politics for granted, which sadly is, I think, what has happened to most of us. All over rural Pennsylvania, which Tom describes as, you know, not where you would think you would start this sort of radical action, all over rural Pennsylvania, they put corporations in their place. And in this era of Wall Street bailouts and BP oil gushers and Citizens United Supreme Court decisions, nothing seems more important to me. In 1998, CELDF began to assist communities to draft and adopt legally binding laws in which they assert their right to self-govern. Now, initially, their work focused on communities facing corporate factory farms, and later the application of sewage sludge to farmland. Remember, this is rural Pennsylvania. And communities across Pennsylvania adopted anti-corporate farming and anti-corporate sludging laws. In 2003, CELDF launched the Daniel Pennick Democracy Schools. And at first I wondered where that name came from. Democracy schools make sense, but who was Daniel Pennick? And he is a young person who died from the effects of some of that sludge. This is a critical tool in grassroots organizing. Communities facing other corporate threats, such as uranium mining in Virginia, commercial water withdrawals in New England, began to take on the work that had been working in rural Pennsylvania. The Legal Defense Fund has now become the principal advisor to activists, community groups, municipal governments struggling to transition from merely regulating corporate harms to stopping those harms by asserting local democratic control over corporations. Tom Lindsay is a graduate of Widener University School of Law. He's the co-founder of both the Daniel Pennick Democracy School and the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and co-author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community. And you can learn more about all of this at CELDF, CELDF.org. Welcome, Tom Lindsay.
Thanks, Terrence, for having us on this morning. I guess I'll echo what Kenny said earlier, which is that's a tough introduction to live up to, I think.
Thank you. And with you, as I did with Kenny, I said I like listeners to get a feel for the people before we launch into the ideas. Yours is not the usual law practice. I'm not the first to say that. Can you briefly describe what your path was to the kind of work that you do today? What were some of the early turning points that led you to say, that's who I am?
Sure. I think I'd go as far back as Kenny, probably, which is to how I was raised. My parents, as well, were, in my case, biology professors teaching at UD. And it wasn't so much the academic background that I think molded me in the beginning, but more so that they were wildlife rehabilitators. And so I grew up in a household that was full of, you know, flamingos with broken wings and rabbits running around in the outdoors, and a couple large tortoises walking around the yard digging holes, and I think that left an indelible mark on me as a youngster. And when I went to college, I wanted to be a marine biologist. That's how I started my college career, and that eventually morphed into thinking about the law and environmental protection. And I come from a family where I'm the first lawyer, for good or for bad.
Right.
but we actually, in law school, we were approached by a bunch of community organizations from across rural Pennsylvania, mostly central Pennsylvania, and community groups that were having all kinds of problems, like a toxic waste incinerator or a landfill that wanted to site within their community. And as many of your listeners probably know, legal advice is not cheap, and a lot of these community groups didn't have two dimes to rub together. And so first out of law school, what we did was we created a law firm to do conventional environmental law. And when I say conventional, I mean the traditional stuff, like appealing permits and going in front of zoning hearing boards, doing conventional type of environmental law for free. We decided to set up a nonprofit law firm that would offer free legal services. And as you can imagine, the line for free legal services went around the block a couple times because a lot of folks are in need of that. And pretty soon we were representing about 300 community clients across the state in the first couple of years that we were around. And in 98, we were created in 95. In 98, we came to a series of conclusions. And one of those conclusions was that conventional environmental law really doesn't give any remedies to communities that are faced with a Monsanto corporation coming in or a waste management corporation coming in or some large corporation that wants to transform that particular community. And so we decided to shift gears, and instead of doing litigation, although we still do litigation, it's much more focused now, and instead of doing permit appeals and begging and pleading regulatory agencies to do the right thing and begging legislators to do the right thing, we began working with communities to actually work legislatively to begin drafting local frameworks of law that did a couple things. One was assert local control to build the type of sustainable community that the community wanted to see in 20, 40, or 60 years. And second, to begin challenging this concept of corporate constitutional rights, that corporations have constitutional rights that they use against the community when it attempts to assert their vision for what they want their community to be. And that work has, you covered most of it in the introduction, but that work has spread from Pennsylvania, where we have about 100 municipal governments that have passed our ordinances, to New Hampshire and Maine, who are fighting companies like Nestle, who are trying to take, in some places, 300,000 gallons of water a day out of the aquifer for those localities, to Mount Shasta, California, where you have a proposal by Pennsylvania Gas to do cloud seeding and water withdrawals, and the community there is trying to stop it, to Virginia with uranium mining, a bunch of different places where we work. And the democracy schools have been used by us to, in essence, begin to train a new generation of community activists who have turned their backs on the state and federal government levels, basically have given up hope that anybody's going to save them, any governmental officials are going to come in to save them, or governmental bodies except for their own. In giving up hope that anybody else is going to come in to save them, they're actually beginning to transform the culture and the law at the local levels to build a system of law that we don't have in the United States today, because most folks, a lot of folks think we have a democracy operating in the United States. These communities, when they run up against Monsanto or waste management or one of the big companies, they learn very quickly that that myth of democratic control is very thin indeed, and that when they begin to push up against it, they begin to see for themselves exactly how municipalities and communities are controlled, and it's by this fusion of corporate power and governmental power that's used to keep communities subordinate to a relatively small number of people within those corporate boards who sometimes are 1,000 or 3,000 miles away from the community where they're doing business.
Okay, I really like the way you threaded that whole thing and clearly lays out both the problem and a potential solution, which, as I said, it was brand new to me the first time you mentioned it, and I imagine new to some of our listeners who are among those who probably had given up hope. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Ken Ozabel, the founder and director of Bioneers, who's been my guest since the top of the show. Their 2010 conference will take place in San Rafael, California, October 15th to the 17th. It will also stream on the web a few hours of it each day, some of the plenary speeches, and then a two-hour backstage at Bioneers, which I will anchor, in which we'll have interaction with some of the key social and environmental and legal innovators that will be there. And you can learn more about all of that at bioneers.org. And now I've brought in Tom Lindsay. He's the founder, executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and he's the co-author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community. And they also, as he said, started the Democracy Schools, which teach this. You can learn more about their work and at CELDF. If you think Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. Tom, is one of the Democracy Schools in California?
The democracy schools are roving. So, for example, Kenny worked with us 1 year to do a democracy school at Bioneers. We generally do them in places where the communities ask for them. So, for example, we've done a couple of mini schools in Mount Shasta, California. We've done a couple in San Francisco. I think we've done about 12 or 13 total in California to this point.
So in other words, what you're saying is rather than having a set of bases where they show up on a regular basis, if someone likes this idea, they can get in touch with you guys and see if they could do one wherever they are.
Yeah, this is community organizing as the focus, and so generally we do them in the communities that are facing a certain threat coming in, and that's where we found them to be most effective. We've graduated about 4,000 people through the Democracy School.
And a Democracy School lasts how many days?
They're two-day events, but if it's in a community that's actually drafting an ordinance with us, we'll extend that out to three.
Okay.
And generally, they're for municipal officials, community leaders, peers go through the school. Basically, anyone with has an interest in a community route for a threat that's threatening to come into that particular community.
Okay, Tom, I'm going to stick with you. And by the way, Kenny, whenever you feel you want to chime in, just let us know, because I know you're there, and we'll bring you back in at the end. But, Tom, can you tell us a story? Tell us a story of one of the communities that was faced with corporate action that overrode the community's desires, and how they became introduced to you, the steps they took, and kind of, you know, just really so people can see the nuts and bolts of what happens when this works.
Sure. I think one of the leading stories that's emerged over the past 2 years is really coming out of the New England area, where you have companies like Nestle Corporation and a company called USA Springs Corporation, which is targeting water-rich Maine and New Hampshire. Bottling plants and bottling operations. And a little place called Nottingham, New Hampshire, it's a very small location, a couple thousand people, where a company called USA Springs decided to set up shop and begin building a water bottling plant and purchase the land to put the plant in. Folks in the community worked for 8 years trying to stop the operation through the conventional regulatory process. So, for example, the company wanted to put a driveway in that would hook up to a state route. So the community group that permit that was issued, saying it was unsafe for the driveway to feed onto a state route, and also argued over the sustainability of pumping a certain amount of water out because the state has a permitting and regulatory system that issues permits to that type of operation. Spent 8 years, went all the way up to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, argued that water should be not considered property that can be privatized, but should be held in something called the public trust, so it should be commonly owned and can't be sold. Old ties to a private company. You know, went through all these court appeals, went through all the permit appeals, did all the hard work that activists do across the country when they're faced with these kinds of operations coming in, turned to the regulatory system for a remedy. And in the end, they lost. The New Hampshire Supreme Court ruled unanimously that there was no such thing as a public trust as applied to water in the ground, and therefore the company could come in and take the water at will. And so they went through this process, and then they came to us.
Can I ask you a question, Tom, before you move to the next stage in this thing? When as you point out, very often this is the case. You fight the good fight and put all the energy and expertise you have in the regulatory battle and so on, and then lose in the courts. This, by the way, doesn't depend on the courts being venal or evil. It is merely that the way that law has been interpreted has led to this thing where if you look at it just as law, precedent, and so on, you may be boxed into some of those things, and that the notion, and I'm asking this as a question, the notion that air, water, and things like that should be in the public trust, should be in the commons, is actually something that people have, while it may have seemed intuitive a few hundred years ago, has now been sort of lost. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Sure. I think you have two or three things intertwined there, which could probably take us 4 or 5 hours to talk about. But just to give the quick and dirty is that most people think the regulatory agencies are there to help them. In other words, they have such nice names like the Department of Environmental Protection or the Environmental Protection Agency. And people actually think that those agencies are there to actually, you know, protect the environment. But the history of regulatory agencies in this country is much different. The first regulatory agency was the Interstate Commerce Commission back in the late 1800s. And it was actually created by the large railroad corporations to keep mostly the smaller railroad corporations out of the business of transporting grain and other products. In other words, regulatory agencies were never really used to protect us, the majority or people or communities. It was they're really corporate tools that are put in place to allow things that would otherwise be illegal. So, for example, if I'm a corporation and I want to dump into my stream that runs by my manufacturing plant, I go to the regulatory agency, and the regulatory agency issues me a permit. And it's not just the interpretation of the law surrounding the issuance of that permit. It's actually the fact that the corporations are generally the ones that wrote those regulatory frameworks in the first place.
And let me cut in one more time. My experience when I've looked at environmental issues on a local basis with a landfill or something like that is that the biggest muscle corporations will fight a regulation until loss becomes inevitable. Then they will switch their tactic and write it so that it serves them and makes it difficult for anyone who can't afford a certain level of business to compete.
Yeah.
Pretty much the pattern, right?
Yeah, I think that's generally true. I mean, for example, in Pennsylvania, the land development corporations actually write the municipality's planning code. And, you know, it's gotten to a point where the development corporations, you know, in those codes, even write provisions. You can set up a taxing body within your municipality, but it's got to have a majority of members from the land development community sitting on the board. And in other words, there's all kinds of ways that they write those things. And when we turn to those frameworks for a remedy to stop something that those frameworks have been constructed to allow,
mm-hmm.
we actually think that those frameworks are there to deliver a remedy. And what we find most of the time is that we're fighting under somebody else's script, that they've written a script for us. Follow it.
And they've defined who we are as a character, and that character usually loses.
Yes. And even monies we spend on trying to fight the permits, we think we're making it more expensive for the corporation to come in, but the monies that the corporations spend are actually tax deductible. So the monies that they spend are necessary, reasonable and necessary business expenses, which are deductible under the tax code for all the lawyers and everything else that they spend defending that permit issuance that has been issued to them. And so we have this myth that the regulatory system is somehow set up to help us and that we can use it somehow, but it's really a different kind of tool. It's a tool that's been written for us. It's a script that's provided to us. And like good little boys and girls in most communities, and a lot of people don't know any better and don't know the history of the regulatory agencies because they have real jobs and are working, taking their kids to soccer practice and everything else that takes up our lives, that they turn to those regulatory processes for a remedy. And, you know, it may take 5 years, 6 years, 7 years of to go back to that regulatory agency, but all we're really doing is making the corporation file a new and improved permit application to get the permit, and we're not really stopping anything, and that's the conclusion that we came to back in 1998.
So now take us back to New Hampshire.
Yeah, Nottingham, New Hampshire went through that whole process, and what's worse, I think, in many ways, is that not only does the regulatory system, it's set up to collapse organizations. In other words, organizations exhaust them within the regulatory system. But the good folks that are supposed to be helping them to solve the problem, like the major environmental organizations, they tend to be wrapped up in the regulatory system as well. And so just like a cattle being herded down into a chute, when these people, communities arise and ask for help, they turn to sometimes the major environmental groups. Major environmental groups send them right down the chute of the regulatory process to a point where they can't win. It's like the cow being herded down into the meat processing same thing, and the bolt shot through its head. Eventually, we lose, and if we win, we don't win much at that bottom point. And yet, we seem to send people right into that. And in fact, as a law firm for several years, we did the same thing, which was to say to a community, "We're sorry, you can't say no to this thing coming in, because that's how the law is set up. A community can't frontally say no to a factory farm, or no to a landfill, or no to any legal use as established under the law." And instead, we were saying, "You can't say no, but you can appeal the permit." Maybe the corporation more money, maybe drag it out long enough so the corporation will give up. But that's not what democracy is supposed to look like. Democracy is supposed to look like majorities making decisions within communities about what they want their community to look like. And that being the law that's made, not being overridden by a small number of people on a corporate board. And so the folks in Nottingham, you know, they came together and said, "Hey, of course we have a democracy and we're going to engage in the regulatory system." They went through 8 years of fighting, came out the other side with a court decision and all kinds of regulatory decisions. First, USA Springs Corporation can bottle water and take 300,000 gallons a day from your aquifer. And Nottingham then turned to us, because in some circles we're known as the law firm of last resort, after folks have been through this meat grinder. And they come to us, and we had just assisted a community nearby to them to pass an anti-corporate water withdrawal ordinance, which actually bans corporations from withdrawing water within a certain municipality, specific municipality. The folks in Nottingham had been watching that work. The folks in Nottingham then held a town hall meeting, because that's how governance is still done in the towns in Maine and New Hampshire, and actually passed the ordinance almost unanimously, one dissenting vote, through the town hall to actually ban corporations from withdrawing water within that municipality. And within that ordinance, it's not only the ban on corporate water withdrawals, but it envisions that there will be a challenge to that ordinance and to that law, because under our system of law, a system in which communities can't say no to corporations coming in that want to take their resources. And so it builds some protective layers around that provision, including a provision that says corporations don't have constitutional rights within the municipality, including another provision that says the state and federal government can't preempt and can't override that ban on corporate water withdrawals in the municipality, all with an eye towards drawing a challenge from the corporation. And when the challenge from the corporation comes, use, for example, Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment, First Amendment rights, whatever in the Constitution that they can use to override what the community has done, then the eyes of community members, the veil kind of gets ripped from them. And this myth that there's some kind of democratic local control that exists in this country is really blown away. And it's that community that's then has begun to move. In Pennsylvania, about 6 months ago, we had a collection of these 100 communities that we've been working with who are now calling for state constitutional change to drive to local governance and to be free from corporate governance from their communities directly into the state constitutional framework. And we think that's, in New Hampshire, another gathering was held a couple months ago, we think that's beginning to cluster these communities to drive constitutional change, because we at least have come to the point where we think constitutional change is what's necessary to liberate these communities to build sustainability at the local level. And going back to what Kenny said, that, you know, he didn't have too much hope. Obama administration, the federal level. Talk to our communities. They've been screwed by the federal level, which puts in preemptive mechanisms all the time. In fact, I just sent Kenny something the other day about the city of Albuquerque that wanted to put in building efficiency standards to cut greenhouse gases in Albuquerque. What happens is the industry group for the refrigeration corporations and air conditioning corporations came and sued Albuquerque, said you can't do that. The federal government and federal efficiency standards that preempt yours. And so actually stopping a municipality from moving quicker and faster than the federal government has done in laying down those federal energy efficiency laws.
This is, by the way, a constant battle with California.
Yes.
California being a leader, struggling as it may, but being a leader in various environmental regulations and then having to fight the government this last time around, that we set tougher air standards than the federal government, and the EPA has always given us a waiver, and then other states follow the California model, and basically people end up abiding by rules. If enough states do it, you get sort of a critical mass, and then people want the reliability of one standard. And I believe it was the Bush administration in the last year of the Bush administration that decided they weren't going to give California that waiver, and that fight went on for quite a while. But yeah, this is something, again, which I think is probably news to a lot of people, that when you hear about some federal law being passed, now, and I'm going to ask you specifically, very often what that means is it preempts the rights of lower levels of government to actually pass tougher or more accelerated standards. Is that the nature of a federal reg, or is it written specifically into each of these laws to do that?
Well, it's generally written into those federal laws. It's expressly preempted in those federal laws, but it can also happen at the state. So just a couple years ago, the state legislature in Pennsylvania passed a law saying municipal governments are prohibited from banning factory farms or passing any regulation of factory farms within their communities.
Was this a specific response to some of your work?
Yes, it was.
And what happened?
It passed, and now the attorney general of the state has filed 8 lawsuits against municipalities in the state seeking to overturn their ordinances. And I guess that brings us to this, you know, my plug for Bioneers in some ways, which, yeah, just to say the story of Nottingham is in that book as well as other stories. But one of the reasons why we love Bioneers is because there's a recognition that good ideas are not enough. In other words, we've had renewable energy. We've known technologies for renewable energies for the past 40, 50, 60 years in some places. But the tomes on renewable energy and the ideas about transportation and energy and manufacturing and all these big areas of the economy that we're constantly dealing with, mostly in an adverse way because communities on the receiving end of it, that we've known that stuff for a long, long time. And, of course, the best innovators, and Bioneers brings out those best innovators, are continuing to and find better ways for them and better mechanisms. But at the same time, the reason why we don't have them, I mean, the reason why solar is not the default in this country, the reason why these technologies have not been implemented is because we don't have the political will to do it. In other words, we don't have the political authority and the legal authority to do it. And so, you know, some people have come to the conclusion that that change is not going to happen at the federal or state level, and that we have to use law. And that's the new, I think that one of the new under that, it's not enough just to think that we can build markets. It's not enough that we can just talk to enough influential people and an idea will spread fast enough and somehow overcome all of the hurdles that have been placed in its way. It's not enough, and it's not fast enough. I think Kenny used this phrase, you know, not big enough, fast enough. And so these communities, like there's a small municipality in Maine that we're now working with to pass a food sovereignty ordinance, which would, in essence, guarantee access to sustainably produced food that municipality, and in fact prohibit corporate farming as a competitive thing that happens within the community that outprices family farmers from being able to access the market, that people are thinking in new ways. They're saying we need to use the law to mandate sustainable agriculture. We need to use the law to mandate sustainable energy. All new developments in this community need to mandate that they have solar in them, either solar hot water or other solar systems, and mandating them through law, which is something different than we've been doing for the past 40 years mostly, which has been, you know, let's build the markets, that's enough to do, good ideas travel quickly, it's enough just to get the good idea out. This is about communities actually using their community majority power to build the world that we so desperately want to build, and to do it fast enough before we go off the cliff, because once closer we get to the cliff, people start thinking about survival. They're not thinking about transforming governance systems.
You said something there about the power of democracy, the power of local communities. If you could, I would think that everything we normally read backs up what the corporations want us to believe, which is that because of various court decisions giving them rights, granting them rights, and so on, that is kind of the lowest level, and that's where you have to play the game. What is the principle that that seems to be below that, and in the context in which that takes place, that allows a community to actually make laws that override those?
Well, we're talking about what a real movement would look like that throws off corporate control of communities. That's what we're talking about. And it's been framed in terms of community self-determination, that communities should be able to build sustainability, whether that's sustainable energy systems, sustainable food systems, that under the current system of law, most legal scholars would treat as well-settled law, that communities lack the power. They lack the legal authority to do that. This movement, which is not quite a movement yet, still a bunch of disparate communities trying to figure out, you know, how to move towards the futures that they want, that this movement is about, in essence, transforming communities and municipalities from being seen in the eyes of the law as just pawns to be used, exploited by a handful of people coming in the corporate form, to actually communities being self-governing majorities who are actually making law that sticks. And to
Terry, can I jump in for a second?
Yes, yes. That's the voice of Kenny Ozabel, the founder and director of Bioneers. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say for one thing that, you know, I think what we're really talking about here is a democracy deficit. You know, across the board, you find actual political action divorced from the vast majority of people of these kinds of issues that Tom is describing. And the work that he's doing is truly at the cutting edge of all this stuff. I've done three of the democracy schools, by the way, and I just really could not recommend it highly enough. But I think what we're also facing now that is really important in context is at 300-plus million people, the U.S. is probably becoming ungovernable, and it's what George Soros calls the morbidification of first principles, you know, or in Eastern ways of thinking, things become massive. So the democracy, the republic on which we were founded, is really, you know, become something quite different from that. And in fact, I'm very amused by the whole Tea Party thing, because if you go know your history at all, the Boston Tea Party was an explicit, you know, very virulent anti-corporate action against the East India Company, you know, the British East India Company, who was had created essentially a monopoly on tea and was going to tax any colonial who sold it, but not the monopoly. And we were born out of an anti-corporate, anti-monopoly movement. So I think we do need a Tea Party. It's just got to be reframed a little bit. And both Tom and his colleague, Mari Margill, will be at Bioneers this year, along with Lynn Twist, who's been working with them in Ecuador. And what Tom didn't get to mention is the extraordinary work that they're doing around the rights of nature. Because by law, it's only people who have any kind of rights, and even then, only some people. What they've done, among other things, is actually in the country of Ecuador to embed in the national constitution the rights of nature, whereby people are empowered to stand on behalf of critters and ecosystems. And this is now spreading in Latin America. It looks like three or four other countries are going to sign on for this.
Yeah, this is, to me, one of the most exciting things happening, and it was one of the questions which I didn't get to. So thank you, Kenny, for bringing that up. I've got to bring this pretty much to a close. Again, the websites to learn more are Bioneers, B-I-O-N-E-E-R-S, bioneers.org, and CELDF.org. CELDF, that's the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.org. Bioneers takes place October 15th to 17th in San Rafael, California. Kenny Ozabel and Tom Lindsay, keep up your great work.